Okay, very good. All right, so lots to do today, nitty-gritty included. I'm going to pass out a new syllabus, and you'll know that it's new because it says revise on the top. So take one of these, and I will explain what is revise. An announcement was sent out by Robin, but in case. Tell me when y'all have it. You are welcome. Okay. I'm just going to stand close because there'll be more people coming in. We were scheduled to have no class next week. Now we do. If you were not able to make it to that class because I already told you we weren't going to have class, then you will want to listen to the tape or come on Tuesday, March 15th. That sounds weird, but I'll repeat. What I'm going to do next week, and we do have class on February 10th, is John Rawls. And I'm going to do that because I have to be away the day before spring break, which is March 3rd. Which is no problem in terms of missing the class because I had scheduled no class for February 10th to keep us on schedule because there were more Thursdays than Tuesdays. So it's all going to work out fine, unless of course you can't make it next week because you thought you had the week off, and my apologies if you're in Disneyland or something. But you can come March 15th or you can listen to the tape, so apologizing ahead of time. Next week we're going to read John Rawls. He's the macro part of deontology, but it's such a political theory that you don't need to know more deontology than you know now in order to understand what he's trying to do with rationing. So February 10th, next week, yes, there's class. We will be doing Rawls. I'll be doing it again on a Tuesday, March 15th. That means that the paper assignment will come out in this class a week earlier. So instead of you getting it on March 3rd, you'll get it February 24th. So you'll get it a week earlier than you would have. That's the advantage to you. And of course, the Tuesday section's gonna have it too. I'll post it, they just won't know what it means. But February 24th is when you'll actually get the assignment, and it will be due on March 17th. So you get an extra week of being able to mull it over because you will have had everything that you need to know to do it. Questions on the convoluted whatever? Yeah?
If we are switching from Tuesday to Thursday,
then this tells you when to come, March 15th.
Okay, yeah, but for the final, for the assignment of the paper, when?
Well, it doesn't matter when you get the assignment because it's not a whodunit. It's the same assignment I've given every day for every semester for 10 years. So it's not like it's top secret and in like the sealed envelope. You'll get it on the 24th because that's the last time you're going to see me before spring break, and I want to give it to you so you can ask questions in class. But if you happen to be in class, not on at all on February 24th, but that week, coming instead for the Barbara Herman lecture coming March 1st on a Tuesday, you will get the paper assignment March 1st, though it'll be on Blackboard by the 24th. I will be in class to explain it to the Tuesday class on March 1st. Okay. So the point of handing out in class is so that you can raise your hand and ask questions about it, not because it's top secret.
And the deal part of the...
The deal?
No, the dual part.
The dual.
Dual part. Dual? Paper, one dual is different than...
Oh, no, that's a range. That's a range. The due date is March 17th to the 22nd, meaning that if you get it in any time between the 17th and the 22nd, you'll get it back within 2 weeks of the 22nd.
Okay.
But if you are outside that range, plus, minus, I don't care, if you handed it on the 15th, hooray. But if you handed it on the 23rd, then there's no clock binding me for return.
Okay. So no matter when you get it, you have to give it back
by the 22nd.
Okay.
That's right. Because I don't know who's in whose class, and I don't care. But technically, each class gets a certain number of weeks, but so what? Everybody can come on the 24th, and everybody can have till the 22nd of March. Okay, any other questions? And my apologies ahead of time for that. Okay, second convoluted thing is the mediation intensives, which, my God, if you followed it, you are really good. Here's what happened. I realized that except for the adults, no one wants to come here spring break. That is, if you are in med school, if you are in law school, if you're in nursing school or whatever, spring break is as sacred to you as Christmas is to Jesus, and you don't want to be here. And that meant that while I had plenty of adults who wanted to come, I mean very senior adults, of course, I didn't have any young people who wanted to come, and that meant that I couldn't fill it. And surprisingly, when I switched it to April back-to-back weekends, the very day I announced it, it filled and it's now full. Though I am taking people on the wait list because people will always decide that they, yes, have to get married on April 3rd or whatever it is. So I will now begin the wait list for the April intensive. It is April 2nd and 3rd, April 9th and 10th. It is just weekends. It involves no work days. And I will probably have one or two spots in the end, even though right now we're waitlist only. That will certainly change as there's some shifting. So the first flyer I'm giving you has the new dates. There is no March intensive. There is no spring break intensive. It's back-to-back weekends in April. If you were registered in March, you've already been transferred over to April. You were the ones who got the first spots. And then overnight, the whole thing filled up, which gave us the idea that we really do need to make sure that we have plenty of intensives that we're offering in that structure of back-to-back weekends. If you're a medical student, we have a special workshop that we're trying to plan for folks in the medical school, but the all others can come to the May intensive, which has not changed at all. It is Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 4-day stretch right after graduation. No classes are in session except the med school, which is why we're trying to do something separate for folks who are in the medical school, because they go till the end of June, unless they're graduating. But the intensive for May is the same structure as was planned. It's a great time to be on Penn's campus because everything is open and there are no people. So it's great, and I have 9 spots taken and 9 left, so there's plenty of room in the May intensive. The next one will be in August, and I don't know yet what its structure is going to be, whether we're going to go back-to-back weekends in it or whether we're going to run it as the 4-day stretch or however it's structured. I want to find out how we enroll for this. But this is for sure. The April is for sure. There'll be absolutely no changes. Stay tuned. There will be an intensive in August, but I don't know what structure yet. Look at me way over here and you all over there. So definitely let me know if you want May, because I will begin to advertise it broadly outside of the MBE in the next week or two. So if you want it, let me know. Okay. Questions on any of that? All right then. Peter Singer. So this piece is written in the early 70s. It's written in a journal called Philosophy and Public Affairs, which of the applied philosophy journals, by which I don't mean bioethics, and I'll tell you what I do mean, it is the Journal of Record. It's the number one journal. And many of the pieces we read in here in philosophical bioethics, that is philosophers writing about bioethical topics, were published in Philosophy and Public Affairs, including, if you were with me in the fall, Judith Jarvis Thompson's piece on abortion. And the piece we'll read in a couple of weeks from Rosamund Hursthaus on virtue theory and abortion. They were all published in Philosophy and Public Affairs. This piece has stood the test of time, at least for the 40 years since it's been published. He is alive and well at Princeton. And as you know, he wrote okay, nobody bought that first argument. Here's another one. Let's see if we can get people to give more money in the New York Times. That said, the New York Times piece was very much him arguing, as consequentialists will, that if option A will not actually produce the greatest happiness for the greatest number because no one will do it, then let's go to option B and see if we can maximize happiness that way. So there's nothing hypocritical about him arguing, all right, I believe what I said, but if I can't get you to do it, let's see if we can get you to do something less. But first, let's see what this argument entails. It is a great articulation of the very high bar that consequentialism can set for what one owes to one's fellow human beings. And we're going to do this analysis in a very philosophical way. Namely, we're going to do the diagramming of this piece as a geometric proof, as an argument, the way that philosophers do when they're trying to look for strengths and weaknesses. And by doing that,
we will engage in what the deontological rejoinders would be to the consequentialist argument, but what I want you to do is think about the consequentialist rejoinders that you might have as a consequentialist to what he's saying. Because, of course, there are, let's just say it's a 50-50 split between folks who reason in consequentialist manner to get to the resolution of their moral conundrums and the other 50% who reason deontologically. I have no idea if that's true, but let's just say. If other consequentialists believed that he was right, then either they think he's right but they can't live up to what he asked them to do, or they just, or we would, well, I won't even put it like that. Let's put it like this. The only explanation for consequentialists believing that he's right is that they believe that they simply can't live up to what is the right thing to do. Because if they thought he that was right, and they thought they could live up to what he's saying, we would have knocked the hell out of poverty and other conundrums, because what he's asking is such a wealth redistribution that we should have seen the other 50% who aren't deontologists and are unmoved doing a lot more charitable giving than they did. My guess is, therefore, that though we might have some people who feel very guilty that they allow themselves to go out to dinner when that money could be spent on biscuits from UNICEF, most people think he's just not right. And so as a consequentialist or a deontologist trying to think about what the most powerful consequentialist rejoinder is, we want to think about how does a consequentialist meet this argument, as well as I will provide some ways that a deontologist would address this argument. Nevertheless, an extremely powerful argument, and at first pass, feels completely Loctite, irrefutable. Some of you were with me in the fall. How many have not been in the fall? How many people did not take 601? Okay, so a lot of you are going to get a whole repeat. Sorry about that, but to make sure that we're all on the same page, let me be brief, but enough that those of you who weren't with us in the fall can will understand enough of what we try to do here when we're looking at an argument. When you read a philosophical argument and you don't break it down into its component pieces, it can be very easy to feel that it washes over you in a way that you're stuck with a conclusion you don't want to accept. And while that can look to folks who are new to philosophy as sort of a hocus pocus, because you say to yourself, it just can't be the case that this conclusion is true, but I have no idea, I just feel like the wool's been pulled over my eyes, but you don't know exactly where the thing went awry by your view. To address that problem, philosophers diagram out the argument. They look at the logical structure, so taking the argument apart, so they can actually address where in the argument did this go off the rails? And that's very empowering. So while it's some sense, if you didn't like geometry the first time, or you know the logic you took freshman year, it can seem a little tedious, it's actually very empowering. It actually gives you the ability to find the weak points in an argument where in prose, it just washes over you. And if you didn't understand why we did what we did in the fall with doing the outline first for the ultimate, for the paper that we did, it was for that very reason. Prose masks coherence in an argument. It has to be built around, of course, the logical structure, and it can be illuminating of the logical structure, but if you don't have a good logical structure, the argument's crap, no matter how much flowery prose you put around it. And if you put a lot of flowery prose around it, then if you're a novice in philosophy, it can wash over you and you feel like there's no holes in the argument and you're stuck. So we're going to start with this argument actually diagrammed numerically. And just as a review for those of you who were with us in the fall or are new, there are two ways to understand how an argument is succeeding in philosophy. And those are the terms we call sound and the arguments we call valid. Valid looks like the more potent praise or award to give to an argument. You might think what you're after is validity, because for heaven's sake, you don't want invalidity. That is true, but valid is what you have when you have been able to graduate with a bachelor's degree in philosophy. Everything that comes out should be valid, and certainly if you're in philosophy and public affairs, you're going to have valid. Valid just means that there's a logical structure. It doesn't mean that any claim that you're making is true. And to say that in very concrete terms, here's an argument that is valid, totally, perfectly logical. And I know I've used this before for many of you, but it's such a classic, I'm going to use it. All men are beautiful. Socrates is a man. Socrates is beautiful. Everyone knows Socrates is a very homely guy, so that can't be true. And yet it's perfectly valid. It's a perfect hypothetical syllogism. So logically, it holds together perfectly, and therefore it gets the designation valid. Yay! Except it's patently false, as the example of Socrates shows. So what you're really after is sound, because sound means that the claims are true. When you have a logical argument, again, review for many of you, new to some, it looks like this. These things are the premises, we'll call those P's, and at the end you get the three-dot triangle, and that's the conclusion. When you have a logical argument, therefore it's valid, and each of these claims is true, 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 then the conclusion has to be true. That's what happens when you take logic in the philosophy department. They'll explain why this is true mathematically and in words, in prose. They'll show you, they can demonstrate to you how you cannot have a false conclusion from true premises. So the only thing that you can do then, when you think that you've got a spurious conclusion, you're pretty sure you've got something false at the end, is to go back to the premises and see if you can find a weakness. And if one claim goes down, the entire thing goes down. Because there is no repairing a false premise. You have to build a whole new argument. So when you find an argument that does not seem like it is true to you, your obligation or your strategy is to go back to the premises and find what is false. And that is what we're going to do. There's only one eraser in this classroom. I have to keep walking back and forth to grab it. What we're going to try to do is see if all of the claims in his case are true. To do that, we're going to diagram the argument. All right, let me take you to the outline. We're going to name the argument, lay it out geometrically. We're going to talk about the way that he anchors each claim by looking at the prose, so you can actually see how this argument gets built geometrically from the prose. The main argument is going to have been diagrammed. You can actually find this on the internet. It was diagrammed by Robert Streifer, who's a friend of mine. He's now an associate professor of philosophy in Wisconsin. But he did this as a graduate student, and I think it's a very good rendition. Philosophers do this to practice. They diagram out arguments, and either they publish them, not in the sense of peer-reviewed journal, but they get them out there, and then people see if they agree with their rendition. The argument hinges on a standard or an ideal that Singer calls, I don't know what the noun should be, things that are of comparable moral importance. And the comparable moral importance standard is what is probably going to be most at issue here. And in a rejoinder to the comparable moral importance standard, which is going to be the linchpin of this argument, I'm going to offer five possible deontological rejoinders. Then I'm going to engage the claim Singer makes that deontologists make a mistake, or all people make a mistake, when they think about donations in these kind of cases as being charitable giving, because charity has the connotation of optional. And he's going to argue it's not charity, it's duty. Now here he's clearly borrowing deontological language, but this would be the duty in a consequentialist argument like this would be the claim that it is what is right to do. That which is right is what is duty for this particular argument. And he's going to argue it's not, you can't call it charity, which makes it sound like you have a choice, when it's actually what is right to do. And we're going to use that to talk about the supererogatory again, because that is one of the great sticking points between the two theories. And then we're going to entertain Singer's two objections that he knows deontologists and others are going to make, well, mostly deontologists. The first is that I might claim to Peter Singer, I am, or, well, this is actually Singer's view, so this is the way that Singer would put it. you, Autumn, are not less obligated just because others could have helped. Whatever my action is that I have to do to maximize the greatest happiness for the greatest number in this case, it is not affected, says Peter Singer, by what everyone else or anyone else is doing. Or it's mostly not affected by the fact of what they're not doing. If everyone else was doing it, that would affect what I had to do. But by the fact that other people are not doing what I am called to do, doesn't mean that I'm not called to do it. So he's going to argue that Autumn is not less obligated just because others could have helped and didn't. And he's going to argue that it could be the case that if Autumn waits to give, Autumn will have less to give, and he doesn't care that I would give less than the people who would get there first. And those are the two things that he's going to try to use to defend the claims against the deontologists who are going to argue that whatever my obligation is, it can't be more than anyone else's obligation. My obligation is equal, and whatever my obligation is, it has to be constant, and it can't dip depending where we are on the timeline, that all human beings' obligations have to be the same across time to others. Okay, so that is our agenda, and we're going to start by diagramming this. Any questions about how we're doing this? Okay, here we go. First premise. Suffering and death from lack of food, shelter, and medical care are bad. Takes a while to get this argument built. Going to be an assumed premise. He doesn't think he has to fight for this one. Two. If it is in someone's power, to prevent something bad from happening, without thereby sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance, she or he should do it. This we get from the thought experiment. Let's go to that to see how he anchors premise number two. Look at page 3. So I'm going to show you on page 3 where he builds the first and the second premise. First sentence of the second full paragraph. I begin with the assumption that suffering and death from lack of food, shelter, and medical care are bad. So I didn't just assume that he assumes it. He tells us he assumes it. He's not going to argue. Drop down to the next paragraph. Next point, next premise. If it's in our power to prevent something bad from happening without thereby sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance, we ought morally to do it. By, without sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance, and we're going to be needing to really examine this. Put it up here. I have no idea why this dry erase board is doing this to us. I mean, first, let's get it up there. Comparable moral importance. I mean, causing anything else comparably bad to happen? Doing something wrong? Or failing to promote some moral good? Some moral good comparable in significance to the bad thing that we can prevent. So again, by without sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance, I mean without causing anything else comparably bad to happen or doing something that's wrong in itself or failing to promote some moral good comparable in significance to the bad thing we can prevent. Comparable in significance. That's the comparable moral standard, comparable moral worth standard that he's using. This principle seems almost as uncontroversial as the last one. It requires us only to prevent what's bad, to promote what's good, and it requires this of us only when we can do it without sacrificing anything that is, from the moral point of view, comparably important. That is comparably morally important. That's what the standard is. And if that's not in jeopardy, then you have to prevent something bad from happening. If this isn't what's in jeopardy. And we're going to spend quite a bit of time in a minute thinking about what would rise to this level, what qualifies here as comparable moral importance, what would be just as bad as the thing that he's talking about, namely suffering and death from lack of food, shelter, and medical care, because that's where we're going to go. Now, look at the next page, because this is where he's going to argue that it is really just so very obvious about how we need to act when we are faced with suffering and death from lack of food, shelter, and medical care. It is as easy, as obviously obligatory, as this thought experiment on the top of page 4. If I'm walking past a shallow pond, and I see a child drowning in it, I ought to wade in and pull the child out. This will mean getting my clothes muddy, but this is insignificant. While the death of the child would presumably be a very bad thing. So, in our thought experiment, we should save a child when risk is muddy clothes. Not drowning, for example, or something else that would be significant, but just muddy clothes. Obviously, nothing is importantly at stake here from a moral perspective, as you know, more of my muddy clothes, and something on the other side of the equation. You got muddy clothes on the one hand, and you got saving a child's life on the other. Not even close in terms of their weight morally, then we should absolutely prevent the bad thing, the death of the child, from happening. So, if it's in my power to prevent something bad from happening, like the death of a child in a wading pool, without sacrificing anything of anywhere near the comparable moral importance, just my shoes getting muddy, then I should do it. That's where we are so far in the argument. Okay, 3. Hence. Whenever you see a hence, a thus, a therefore, it's a wrap-up. So this better be hence 1 and 2 comboed, because that's what hence in philosophy means. It means I am now going to combine two premises. We have exactly two premises. There are only two to combine. It better be 1 and 2. Oh, he actually knows what he's doing. It is the combination of 1 and 2. Hence, you're going to watch me combine 1 and 2 here. If it is in someone's power to prevent suffering and death from from lack of food, shelter, and medical care without sacrificing anything of, of comparable moral importance, anything of comparable moral importance she or he should do it from one and two. Remember geometry? It's the exact same thing. All we've done is talk about suffering and death from lack of food, shelter, and medical care. We already said that that experience was bad. If we are in trying to prevent something bad and we're worried about the something, we don't have any problem substituting in for the something that is bad. I shouldn't have done that in. Where's my red? All I have to do now is substitute in the something, suffering and death, from lack of food, shelter, and medical care. Just a substitution, very simple, right? Okay. Four. It was in your power to donate the extra money you spend on famine relief. And that's just a shorthand for suffering from lack of food, shelter, and medical care. And the way he's going to anchor this is that people in the United States, overwhelmingly, though not universally, so if you yourself are on the street and have no food, shelter, or medical care, then it is not the case for you that four is true. And yet for the overwhelming majority of Americans, it is true. And so he believes that this is true of anyone with any kind of surplus income that goes beyond minimal existence, the supporting of minimal existence. And if you truly, Josh?
Is that how he lives his life?
Well, that's a different question, so hold on to it. Let's ask the question of hypocrisy, because it's not a prime value in consequentialism. But let's document it. And get it on the board so that we can talk about it. All right, number four we just did. I'm just going to draw a line here because my outline and my argument are bleeding together. Okay. Five. By donating, to reputable charities. I mean, let's not try to take this one out because you know of one charity where if you donated, it went to the dictator anyway, so you didn't do any good. Let's leave those out, only including reputable charities. If you donated to famine relief, and again, I'm pushing together food, shelter, medical care needs, you would have prevented suffering and death from lack of food, shelter, and medical care without sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance. And therefore, you should donate. Your extra money. After you pay for your basic existence to famine relief. And that's from 3, 4, and 5. Okay. So, now we look at the argument. It is a valid argument. So if it isn't the case, and let's just call a spade here, you should donate all your extra money after you've paid for the food, shelter, and medical care that you need to famine relief. So what premises do you want to look at? I want to look at each one, but which one do you want to go after as a potential weakness if, in fact, you believe that 6 is false? If you believe the conclusion is false, what premise is it that you want to question the soundness of, the truth of?
Comparable moral.
Important. All right. Which one? The comparable moral importance one is 2. By donating money to charities, to famine, you would have prevented suffering and death without sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance. I see.
Well,
it also has the comparable moral importance in it. That is true. Number 2 is the question of whether you ought to donate, you ought to prevent something bad from happening without sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance, that you're obligated unless there is something. Oops, I used green. That wasn't helpful, was it? I'm going to erase green and use purple. Because I do, you're right, we can absolutely look at number 5. But let's put blue for the comparable moral importance bit. Purple. And comparable moral importance. Okay? So this is what I'm calling the strong second premise, though 5 says, the force of 5 is really, by donating, you would have prevented suffering. So without it, blah, 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 blah. So this part, this second part, is really just bringing along the rest of number 3. But it does definitely have the comparable moral importance thing in it. But either way, the comparable moral importance issue and claim is one of the central ones we're going to want to think about. And we saw that as, you know, we had it that basically tipped off a little bit here, because I had said we're going to, you know, you're right, we want to really think about this. Let's look at premise number 1 first before we do premise number 2 and perhaps by association number 5. What about the idea that suffering and death from lack of food, shelter, and medical care are bad? Is there any way to unseat that premise?
Some would argue that overpopulation, this is just a means of...
Okay, be a fairly draconian... consequentialist argument to say that there's a little bit of evolution and survival of the fittest going on here, but that nature taking its course overall could produce the greatest happiness for the greatest number, though a great deal of suffering in the short run, right? It's probably not a lot of takers of that position who would want to unseat number 1 in this room. There might be, but yes, if your view was that while suffering and death are bad, in one sense, they're actually important in another sense. So that would be one way of unseating premise number 1, right? And that's true. And if he is working with folks who believe that, what is the status of this argument for that group of people? If you think that suffering and death from these things, in the big picture, isn't actually bad, then what does this argument say to you? Right, you're done. So one of the things that happens in an argument is if there is an assumed premise, and for reasons that you can justify, and that was one, we'll see if there's any others, if you can justify its rejection, you have no obligation to go any further. You have simply denied the all-important first premise. Done. So you're done.
Didn't he deny his own first premise later on in the second article that you read? Didn't he say that, you know, maybe it's not our duty to give money if they're not doing anything about population control?
But that wouldn't be the first. That wouldn't be the first premise. The first premise just says that it is a bad thing that people suffer.
Right. But he also went to say that then you should be giving to population control.
So right.
It was still the governments themselves should be doing something about it.
That may be true. That's part of how over all of those 30 years, when he wrote that, he had collected the arguments that really it should all be me until the point of I'm close to poverty when nobody else, including governments, are doing anything and they could do so much more. So that's part of his answer 30 years later to heavy, consistent, unrelenting criticism of his objections. But the first premise, when you're trying to address a premise, you got to stay exactly with what the premise is trying to claim. And the claim is simply, this stuff is bad.
Well, you could argue, although I would never do it personally, that this is just natural selection.
That's his argument.
It's a good thing.
Yes, okay. You could argue that. Are there and he says people can hold all sorts of eccentric positions, and perhaps some of them would not follow that death by starvation is in itself bad. It's, you know, difficult to refute such positions, so I'm just going to take this assumption as accepted, and those who disagree need read no further. In other words, a philosopher can very legitimately, it's not a defensive move at all, say, if you do not buy the fundamental first premise of this argument, that could be a metaphysical premise, and in some ways I think this is a value judgment, whether you think it's bad or not, and if you don't think it's bad, you're not going to get motivated to care, because you're starting from such a very different place. You might be starting from a concern about the greatest happiness for the greatest number, in which case you think ultimately we actually will serve humankind by suffering and death from food, lack of food, shelter, and medical care. You could, and still care about the happiness of others. But on the other hand, you just might not care about the happiness of others. Why might you not care about the happiness of others? Yes, you're a sociopath, you're right, you know. But how could you be a moral person and not care about the happiness of others?
Unless you place moral value on different moral values on different...
Like what?
Well, poor people aren't contributing. That's what I meant by natural. These are the people that aren't contributing, so therefore, blah. I mean, I don't believe it, of course, but one could make that argument that...
This premise, though, doesn't specify who is actually suffering. It only says, so it could be you, for example. It could be anyone who would not have medical care. So it's not saying, well, these are the lazy people and we don't have to care about the lazy people. This is just a general claim that suffering and death from these things is not inherently bad. Who would make the argument that this kind of suffering is not inherently bad? We already had one economic argument. You both have articulated in a way. How could you make a non-economic argument, a moral argument, that suffering from in these ways was not bad?
Well, dictators probably don't have a problem with it.
But they're not, we don't consider them moral. So, yeah, I want an argument that is moral.
Gandhi refrained from eating.
Okay, it could be that if you did it for choice, the implication here is that these people are not choosing it. How could you argue that there might be suffering from starvation, lack of medical care, and lack of shelter that you did not choose isn't necessarily bad?
You say that there are eternal rewards for it.
Right, and there might not be just internal rewards. There might be...
Is it eternal?
Oh, eternal, that's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right, the other group that might think this would be the folks, and there's not that many versions now of, for example, Christianity that holds this view, but that suffering is in itself redemptive. And so what is handed to you, I mean, think, if you don't even, you don't see this in Judaism much, though the big story comes out of the Hebrew Bible, and that's Job. There was a great deal of suffering in Job. Now, that is a story that I'm sure is told at temple at times, but it's in its manifestation in the world's big religions. Judaism doesn't tend to make it the way that Christianity, certain versions, have. So there are plenty, especially some versions of Catholicism, not liberation theology, for heaven's sake, and that's actually what liberation theology was fighting. The view that this kind of suffering on earth was in some way redemptive. That's why the the big prayer right after you come up the top of the rosary bead, the Hail Holy Queen, has all of this gnashing of teeth and wailing in this valley of darkness. You know, that's part of this prayer. Speaking to the fact that suffering is itself possibly, it can be redemptive, and is itself important and one of, you know, one of the trials from God. If that was your view, then you certainly wouldn't think that you should go mucking around with it. If you also thought that this kind of lot in life was handed out to you because you weren't part of the elect, for that, you know, one of the views of some of the Puritan sects was that you had economic privilege because you were graced by God. So if you didn't have it, I'm not sure why I should give it to you. That was a decision made by God. Now again, these are not big contemporary Christian movements, and there's far more religions now that worry that suffering and death are bad. But those would be moral ways. I'm not saying the economic argument isn't moral. I'm saying directly deontologically arguing that number one is false. You just don't see very many people holding the view, but you could.
Or they deserved it. These are bad people for whatever reason.
Yeah, that's the elect argument, so, right? That's the Calvinist. I mean, it's old-fashioned. Like today, if you're a Methodist, you're very unlikely to hold this view. But the original Calvinites had the view that look around, and those that are prosperous, for example, had the grace of God shown to them. That's a very different argument than Job. Job was a chosen man because he was cursed in this way and still endured. So there can be lots of reads on how you got at the short end of the stick, but you might not want to reject premise one from it, though most of you do. And if you do want to reject premise one, you can leave now, because he absolutely isn't going to convince you and he already knows it. So very good. Okay, number one, done. All right, what about number four? It was in your power to donate the extra money you spent on famine relief. It is in your power to donate money. Let's just say that. I don't want us to quibble about extra, because then you can say, well, I don't have any extra because I have my Beamer payment, I've got my McMansion payment, I don't have anything extra. That's, of course, not what he means. He means that if you tightened the belt, if you lived in a way that recognized the serious moral claims at stake here, you could donate. What do you think of that? Who is the you? Who is not in the you? So he cares, he thinks a lot of people are, but can you tell me who might not be? Who would get a free pass on four? What kind of, and I don't go outside of the U.S.
Below the poverty line.
Yes, if you're below the poverty line, you're clear. Right. Absolutely, especially the poverty line in the U.S., because it's so paltry low that it's hard to survive when you're at the poverty line. So even a little bit above, I'd say. Okay, who else? We don't classically think that students on full-out loans, for example, med students, law students who are living entirely on loan for their living expenses are at the poverty line, because, you know, oddly, graduate students can't get food stamps, for example, so we don't think of them as poverty line, and yet it's pretty darn poverty line, right? To be a grad student, you know, PhD, MD, dental, law, when you're taking out loans for the money, it's hard to turn around and say, and you should give some of that away. Well, wait a minute, borrowing money and then giving it to some other person doesn't seem like the right moment in one's life to be engaging in this. So that would be someone, that's true.
Children
would not qualify, that's right. Now what he would want to point out is that some people that you might think would qualify as not having to give turn out actually to give quite a bit. Who are, for example, what's the demographic that gives some of the most amount of money percentage-wise of income? Obviously, you get, you know, some people in various classes, but what's the surprise? What class ends up giving quite a bit of money relative to what?
About religion or class?
The more or less.
Yes, and of course, religion and class can overlap, so I don't want to speak about religions per se, but you're right. People in the, let's call them the working class, who are highly religious, tend to donate actually quite a bit. Those, for example, who tithe. If you tithe, because that is what you believe as your religious view, you might be giving 10% of your income, and even some of the big donors we talk about famously may not be actually giving 10% of their income. 10% is a lot.
But
tithing.
Not necessarily giving to a charity.
No, I'm not talking about, I'm talking about the capacity to give it all. So what I'm trying to argue here is that that it was in your power to donate extra money. It could be that that someone who's, let's say, a devout Christian who believe, I mean, there's lots of devout Christians who don't tithe, but you're a devout Christian who believes in tithing 10%, right? So, you know, you can imagine the kind of denominations I'm talking about. I know people who are tithers and will give 10% of their income. Now, they give 10% of their income to a charity that they call the church, and the government recognizes that as a charity. Now, you might not think as it is upholding an institution that serves a very local group and a local need that it's not charity in this sense, but what I'm talking about is it's surprising how when people care enough about a cause I don't know if religion is the right way to phrase it. I'm not sure the right way to phrase it is as a cause, but if you care enough about your money supporting some particular good that is not your own personal economic well-being, it's surprising how much people can find in their income to donate. That's what I meant here. That's all I meant. That there are people who make very much under the median income for a family of four who end up giving 10% of their income to the cause they believe in, which is their church. And therefore, it is true, I want to argue, that number four tends to be true, with the perhaps exceptions of those who are at the poverty line and those who are on full-out loans to live. There is the possibility, it was in your power, if it was in their power, it was in your power to donate extra money. Now, you may not want to donate it to famine relief, and that's just a metaphor here, right? He understands that, for example, in the Katrina crisis, for example, famine isn't what you would be donating for. So we don't want to get too fixated on what are you giving the money for. He would have been happy if you took yourself down, basically, to marginal utility and gave that money to the Katrina rebuild of whatever. Maybe you'd call that food, shelter, and medical care. I simply mean to say here that he's not trying to say the only causes that are extreme here are food, shelter, and medical care.
So just out of curiosity, what does he say about the fact that, for example, Jews pay to their synagogue dues rather than tithing, and oftentimes it'll be more expensive than the tithings that people give to churches, but it's not considered charity because you're required to pay it.
That and where does the money go? To build?
It goes to the synagogue, just like a tithing would go to the church.
Yes, but the thing about the tithing to the church is that the tithing to the church doesn't just, and this is probably true of the dues, so that's why I'm asking you, but for example, in Catholicism, every week, the money that's collected at collection, let's say somebody is tithing, and I know Catholic families who do, it's not as common as in some Protestant denominations, but those who are tithing, this week it goes to the bishop's famine fund. The next week it goes to Catholic Charities. The next week it goes to the campaign against abortion. And the next week it goes to the anti-death penalty. And the next week it supports the priest's salary. And the next week, so that it is going to the church. But it isn't actually just sitting in that local parish to pay for the food, the lights, the whatever, or the salary of the priest. So if it's the case that for example, is it more akin to the way that you give to a private school? Every bit of money you give to a private school is used to support that institution. None of it goes outside of the school itself. Is that what the dues are like in Judaism, or is it more akin to Catholicism, where when you give to the church, you are actually also supporting many of the charitable causes that extend beyond, and I don't know.
It's the latter.
Yes,
it's
there's
Josh.
Yeah, there's
it's
social.
The latter.
It's the latter, then it doesn't
yeah,
matter that
absolutely.
The government thinks
there's
it's required.
Action.
Well, it's not only that. It's poor people, and they give to non-Jewish causes.
Fine. So. Then it's just a technicality that it's called dues. That's tithing. That's the same thing. All I mean to say is that people at very low incomes who are devoutly Jewish will make the payment to that synagogue, as people who are devoutly Christian will make the tithes to that church. And all that is done to say it was in most people's power. That's all I'm trying to say here. So I'm not trying to make any distinction about whether somebody calls it charity or dues or required or whatever. If it's going to support what we owe in the world to other people, then it's called charity. in this definition. So it sounds like it all is qualifying. And all I meant to say was sometimes we think only the wealthy have it in their power. The fact that many people who are not wealthy give to their important religious causes shows that that's not.
Does it play any importance or difference the fact that the wealthy people get a tax break on this? The people who are just below
right?
the poverty line get no tax
I know, right?
whatsoever.
Right, exactly. So everything I ever give, I get a third back. What?
It behooves the wealthier person to give more. They're not really doing that, I don't think, out of moral reason. They're doing it for tax purposes.
In fact, that's why charitable giving, folks who work in development don't take vacation until New Year's Day, because the tax break means that they're going to be very, very busy in the last few weeks of the year. Exactly. And that's another part of the, you know, there are a lot of people who have the capacity to give, and some actually give without reward, and others actually get a third of it back, for example. Okay, so number one and number four seem pretty solid. That's what this exercise was about. So I am going to give them a green checklist. There are some people who will disagree with one. They've left the room. Very few people are going to disagree with number. Nobody's going to disagree with number four. We might quibble about who has the power. We already said there are some who don't. Most do. Done. We can't quibble with number three because it's just a logical combination of one and two. And so, indeed, as you said right from the beginning, we are going to worry about five, and we're going to worry about number two. Now, five is really the spirit of saying that when you donate, you didn't have any problem with something of comparable moral importance. And two is saying if you can do it without comparable moral importance being infringed, then you ought to do it. So they are really very, very close, and they are what we're going to talk about here with the comparable moral importance standard. Because indeed, let's put the red instead of the green here. If you are going to worry about this argument, you're probably going to start with what I call the strong second premise. Let's remind ourselves how Peter Singer anchors the strong second premise with a thought experiment that argues that if someone's life is at risk and the only thing that you have at risk is muddying your shoes, there is absolutely nothing at stake for you of any moral importance at all. Maybe you've got even expensive shoes. That's not of moral importance compared to a child's life. So on this scale of moral importance, your shoes are trivial, and someone's life, a child's life, is extremely high on the moral importance standard. And that seems completely not controversial in his thought experiment. But in order for us to understand the relevance of his thought experiment to our giving to the point of marginal utility, we're going to want to think about what would rise to this level of comparable moral importance for him of the child's life in the thought experiment. And it's not just a child, it's a person's life. Because if you are dying because you have no medical care, dying because you have no food, dying because you have no shelter and protection from the elements, that is a pretty high bar of moral importance. And certainly, wet shoes isn't going to rise up there. Let's talk about what does rise up there, and then we can see whether we agree with him in what his central claim is, namely, that unless whatever it is that would be sacrificed gets up here, then you should sacrifice it in order to achieve this for someone else. Because that is the argument. Once again, he's arguing that if whatever it would cost me would be of such moral importance that it would rise to this same level as, or somewhere around, you know, it doesn't have to be technically, but in this bracket here, unless it's up that high in terms of moral importance, then anything below it, I should sacrifice, I should be willing to compromise on in order to do some good for something of superior moral importance. So now when we look at comparable moral importance, we're looking at that stuff, those actions that cause something comparably bad to happen, that are themselves doing wrong, that are failing to, that would cause me to fail to produce some other moral good that would be as powerful. So what kind of things are, and it has to be comparable and significant, what kind of expenses and concerns that you have in your life should we protect from sacrifice in order to, and exclude protect before we give the rest of our money away? What kind of things will meet this criteria of not causing, that would be something comparably bad, that would be doing wrong, that would fail to promote some good, that would be comparable in significance? What stuff do you buy that would be up here?
I mean, besides supporting shelter them. And...
Okay, so right. Your own food, shelter, and medical care.
And then your
right? Supporting a family.
And your family's food, shelter, and medical care. Definitely. He's certainly not going to ask you to not protect your children with their food. Now, it's great that you feed your children. I often do myself. But what is it that you are supposed to pay attention to as you're feeding them? In terms
expense.
Of comparable, what?
Expense.
Because?
You can buy the food cheaper, and you can buy
then what?
Less of it, and you can...
Yeah, and it's not like you should say, you know what, just one glass of milk for you. Not
no,
that you
not
could
the
get
organic milk. You buy like the
right. Maybe you don't need the organic milk. Exactly. I mean, if that is of such moral importance that it rises to the level of some child's food, shelter, medical care they're not getting, fine. Spend money on the organic market. But if it's not that important, then I question it. Okay. What else in revolving around food? So this is such a low ball question. Not amount, yeah, amount, but where, what, okay, so we could just say, okay, spend as much as you want on food. What would, is that, would that be true? We already talked about groceries. How else do you feed your
going
family?
Out to dinner.
Going out to dinner, for example. Some of us in our, you know, dual career, overscheduled life end up going out quite a bit. Does that have to be true? Do you have to go out for dinner? That's the only way you could feed your family? Those are the kind of questions that you would want to ask, even though it seemed like a no-brainer that you would be spending money on your food and that food of your family. So once again, it's a very cheap way out to say, oh, I'm very sorry. I mean, my food budget for my family of four, where two of those people are 8 and 9, is $2,000 a month. So that's, how could I give any money away? My food budget's $2,000 a month. He wants you to take a very hard look at your food budget if it's $2,000 a month, because it includes going out to places that you ought not to be going to at all, because somebody else is getting a UNICEF biscuit if they're lucky.
And so he, I presume then that Peter Singer lives in a shelter.
But see, that's again, that's the question, we're gonna get to it. But remember, there is no hypocrisy in believing, first of all, I got to tell you, the guy's pretty bare bones to begin with. I mean, and he, if anybody is living up to it, I'd have to say he's a good candidate with his, you know, ratty sweaters and you know,
disheveled appearance,
little yeah, and you know I remember I had a dinner. I went to a dinner with him at Princeton. His dog came too, and the like. But at any rate, the thing about consequentialism, though, is that to believe that this would be the best option and to not be able to live up to it is not hypocrisy. It's just not to be able to live up to your own ideals. And that doesn't mean that you shouldn't promote that way of living to other people. In fact, if the only way that you could promote it would be to dishonor it, you don't even have to worry about living up to it. It's still all good. If you have to be a professor to promote these ideas, and that's the salary that enables you to do it, then, you know, you're... But more importantly, hypocrisy is not a problem in consequentialism, because you don't have the principle, I ought only to live by my values. You can say, it is the greatest good for the greatest number. It's an ideal to shoot for, absolutely. I just can't live up to it. I do the best I can. That's not a problem. Let's talk about shelter. Is it on the same point? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. If you're going out to eat, then what about the tips that you leave? Like a lot of people here depend on...
So one of the questions, one of the consequentialist rejoinders is going to be a concern about the economy. So let's bracket it and get to it. Yeah. Okay, so we did talk about food. It's very easy to say, I don't have a whole lot of money left over because I have to provide shelter for my family. What do we have to worry about when we're talking about shelter?
Area you live in, how big's the house, how nice is the house?
Yeah, the starter house in Princeton costs $500,000. You have to live in Princeton? Is that the only place you can live? You can't live in Lawrenceville, it's right next door. You have to live in Princeton. Can't get a house, you can't even get a standalone house in Princeton for $500,000. It has to be a townhouse. $600,000 starts the tiny, well actually if it's totally run down and the kitchen has a sink that has pipes that are exposed, you could get that for about, I don't know, $400,000 if it's a standalone house. If you have a house that actually has real plumbing and a kitchen that's not from 1949, and I don't mean nostalgia, then you're looking at a standalone house of $600,000. That's your bare minimum. The median income in the United States is $60,000. You're in the top 3% of earners in the U.S. If you make $290,000, in order to get a starter house in Princeton, you need $600,000. Shelter, you have to have that, because if you live somewhere else, maybe you could have a decent house, meaning ones that actually had plumbing that worked, for $200,000, and that would be a net savings over the lifetime of $400,000. So when you go wah wah to me about how you don't have any money because your $1.5 million house takes every dime you've got in Princeton, then his answer is you shouldn't be living in the $1.5 million house in Princeton. So we have to be careful even when we talk about food and shelter. Medical care is different because he's not going to say you shouldn't have a prescription plan or whatever. So I don't think he is, though, going to talk about some parts of American medical care. It's not going to be that you should have cheaper insurance. It's not going to be that. But there are aspects to American medical care that may be, you know, not typical, but I'm talking about the kind of frills. What kind of thing could you do without? What kind of thing in medical care would you, he think
concierge
you could do?
Concierge care.
Yes, I think you could do without the pavilion, right? Which I myself personally will not like to do without, thank you. I don't care that it's $500 in a suite. And if you book it, the first question is, now who will be staying with you for the evening? Right, I think you could do without that. You could double up and get the regular kind of room, not the $500,000 over the top, right? What is it?
Let's talk about the pavilion. Patients are nasty.
The patients are nasty in the pavilion?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're entitled.
Of course they are. They're entitled, thank you, to the $500 worth. If you're only there one night and you're on a liquid diet, you don't even get the gourmet chef that they pictured with the hat on the china. You get your Jell-O in the china. And that's not good enough.
What about if you're using name brand instead of generics for your prescription?
Right, exactly. Especially for drugs like Tylenol. Right, exactly. I never trust anything that says acetaminophen. It's got to say Tylenol, thank you. I don't know if there's any difference between that, but I'm not going to trust it. Same thing with ibuprofen and Motrin. Only Motrin for me, just like it's got to be Frosted Flakes and not whatever that thing is from ShopRite. Lance and I, the guy who teaches, you know, on the, you know who I mean, Lance Wheeler,
yes.
He's an instructor here. He and I went to the beach together in August to write a paper, and we went into a place called the Acme. And I was like, oh my God, what is this place? The produce is gross and the potato salad smells. She's like, this is just a regular grocery store, Autumn. This is where most people shop. Well, it's not Wegmans or Whole Foods, let me just say. Yes, exactly. The generic is not what the Princetonians are used to, even if it's acetaminophen. Okay, not too much to save though in medical care, a lot of savings in shelter, a lot of savings in food, so don't get yourself all comfortable because every dime goes to being house poor. Okay, what else? What else do you think would rise up here? We wanna, it's such a radical claim that I'm willing to give you stuff that on the comparable moral importance that's not just food, shelter, medical
care. Education.
Yes, exactly. I am willing to give you education. Now, what do I mean by giving you education? What am I going to grant you are allowed to put your money?
Debt repayment.
Okay, debt repayment, because you were stupid enough to go to a place that actually caused you some debt, perhaps. Now, maybe it was medical school, so we'll forgive that. Let's talk about where it might have been prior to medical school.
Private education versus
hello.
Public.
Let's worry about it. Now, I know you're going to tell me that Peter Singer doesn't teach at Rutgers, he teaches at Princeton. And so we have a point there. So you might get away with it on this view by arguing that a private education at the collegiate level could give you more advantages to get the job that gets you the money, that gets you to be able to give more of your salary. Because of course, if you make $500,000 when all is said and done, and you give 50% of it, oh, you're gonna have to give a lot more than that, thank you. If you give 80% of it, and now you have $100,000, you have given $400,000 thanks to going to Princeton. That more than offsets the fact that you could have gone to Rutgers. Now, that's just one kind of formula, but the point is, public and private colleges, I think, not so bad. What other kind, what?
I'm talking about prior college.
And that's where it gets a little concerning, right? Exactly. How much does it cost, for example, to go to a private elementary school around the city of Philadelphia?
Good. 20 grand.
Yeah, it costs 20 grand. That's what it costs, yeah. And if you go to the private high school where you don't board, but not a boarding school, it's about 30 to 35, that's right, a year. That's right, for elementary and for high school. And I was very saddened to hear the story of a friend of mine who spends $40,000 a year on the Hun School at Princeton, and that child got into the University of Vermont. Hello, every public school in Vermont, everybody goes to the University of Vermont. That was not worth it, in my view. $120,000 down to go to the University of Vermont.
They didn't know that in advance. They were shooting for the top.
I understand. But unfortunately, they should look at some placement statistics between the local public schools in Princeton and the private schools. $120,000 that would buy a lot of UNICEF biscuits for the University of Vermont or Loyola in Maryland. Oh my frickin' God. Okay, that is not good. That is just, from this perspective of comparable, more important. You like Loyola in Maryland?
No, Loyola is a private school.
I know, well, but for heaven's sake, you're better off going to Rutgers with the number one philosophy department in the country, or Penn State, that has every course you've ever wanted to have, than to go to Loyola.
I see what you're saying.
Right, like I know these things from this perspective. I do graduate admissions. I sit here looking at the transcripts coming through, and I see a 3.5 from Rutgers or a 3.5 from Loyola. I'm like, even Steven. I don't say, well, it was a private school. Really? Not. University of Vermont 3.5 and Loyola. No.
Gotcha.
Public school, thank you. So here's where it's hard to say, and I'm vulnerable to this. The fact that my kids went to the Princeton Friends School for kindergarten is absolutely the reason they are going to be making the $500,000 that will give me it. Really? For kindergarten? In that kindergarten, they didn't even learn anything. It was just a play program for $20,000. The way that people spend money in the upper middle class doesn't make it, you can't connect the dots to charitable giving at the end. Not that early.
But you gotta go to the private school early on to get into the private school later to get into the private college to be able to make that money.
Yeah, I mean, according to the woman who wrote PrEP, who's made sure no one ever goes to Groton, that's not true, of course, because she went to public school till eighth grade. Of course, she bombed out terribly at Groton, which is why she wrote the book PrEP. Or at least that's the story of the kid who goes there. No, you're shaking your head?
She's the sister of a kid that was in my class.
Yeah, it's probably not true of her, but it's true of the protagonist.
I didn't go to Groton, though.
Either way.
I'm just clarifying. No.
Thank you. Either way, the protagonist in the story goes to public school through eighth grade, then she goes to Groton. She's very far behind. She ends up at the University of Michigan. And if she had gone to the public school in Michigan, she would have also gone to University of Michigan. So, okay. Any rate.
You know, you've added a very different dimension to this of time, which the famine is of the moment, but this is now, well, what I could do in 30 years or 20 years, I don't know. So you've actually added, I mean, to me, education, child's life, I mean, I could skip a quarter, so I'm not sure how I would make that moral decision.
Except that there's always a famine. That's the problem. There's always a famine. There's always a need of biscuits. There's always a tornado. So it would be true. This would be called what the Kantians call the true need, the emergency need. But unfortunately, there's so much of the world's population that lives in poverty that this heightened sense of, oh my God, is happening somewhere, that if there really is a moral justification to give your children the education that will enable them to be productive members of society and therefore givers and carers of other people who are less well off, you can't say, but I'm not going to care about that right now because there's just too much famine currently. There's always too much famine currently. All right, what else do we have here? We're at almost 6 o'clock, so we want to build this list. What else do you spend your money on that might be able to qualify? I'm not going to, no to
vacations.
Private school early ed. What is it?
Vacations.
Oh, comparable moral importance? Not even, no.
Visiting family? Traveling to visit family?
Yes. I think travel to visit family will be okay. What else? Okay. And the only place we could meet was Cancun. I know. Of course. Yeah, clothing is part of the shelter, of course. Now, of course, when it comes to clothing, thank you, did you need those earrings? Because I bet you wouldn't be naked if you didn't have them.
She might feel naked.
She would, and I'm sorry of it. Just like I feel completely out of my element at the Acme. It doesn't mean it's true. What else? Retirement? Got to eat, otherwise somebody is going to give you the biscuits, right, when you're old. What else that you spend your money on? Well, work-related costs. Do you need the fancy iPhone? You probably don't. Do you have to have a computer? For some people's jobs, you do. You certainly have to for some jobs and a cell phone. You might even have to have a cell phone for safety. You might feel like, well, wait a minute. I travel, I leave Philadelphia 3 nights of the week at 1 a.m., 1:30 in the morning, that's a true story. I am not going to be a woman traveling alone without a cell phone. So I'm sorry, that's of comparable moral importance to me.
Transportation.
Mm-hmm, transportation. Now, let's talk about transportation. Is it the case that your Honda Civic would run just as well as your BMW? Probably. Right?
German engineering,
exactly. I have to tell you that my 1994 Camry, which has, 280,000 miles on it, starts every day and has ever since we've had it, and count the years, 1994. I don't want to hear about German engineering because I'm talking about Japanese engineering, and there is a lot of cheap Japanese cars. And if you want my, I just sold my Camry about, I sold the one that had 322,000 miles. It was also in 1994, and it's still running in Princeton. I waved to it as it goes by, and that was 3 or 4 years ago. So believe me, you don't need the Beamer. I know you think you do. And I think I need mescaline greens, but I'm telling you, iceberg actually is called food in many parts of this country. Okay, there isn't a lot up here. What do you notice here about what's not on the list that you spend money on and are not sorry of it before you read this article? Now you're sorry of all of it. But before you read this article that was not up on this list, obviously you do spend money on food that isn't biscuits, high nutrition biscuits. Obviously you spend money on shelter that isn't a shack and it is location, location, location. And of course you have to have some health insurance. But besides the wiggle room here where there was maybe a private or public school, what do you spend money on that until now you thought was justifiable?
Vacation.
Vacation was one.
Entertainment.
What is it?
Entertainment,
right.
Possession.
Things, objects, right, exactly. I had this big debate today with my designer about whether we're going to remat my 500-year-old Gregorian chant. It's actually an authentic Gregorian chant. It's on animal vellum, and now that we've just done the whole living room over in Pottery Barn, you can see where this is going. It doesn't match anymore that it's a cranberry mat, but of course there's only one place in the city, Ursula Hobson, who can actually handle a 500-year-old print, so it's like a conundrum about how we're going to get it there and how we're going to transport it. Things. Not
museum.
On the list. What?
Give it to the museum.
I mean, do you think how much firewood is in the frame? Exactly. It's animal vellum, for heaven's sake. Someone could wear it. Exactly. All right. Things, entertainment, vacations, fancy food, even just food that's not peanut butter. Clothing of an upper scale, meaning, not from the thrift store. Jewelry. What else? what is it? Alcohol, right? That's right. I used to work for a guy who had a bigger wine budget than my whole food budget per month. Exactly. And we'd go to restaurants and you'd be like, I see the oak undertone with the cherry overlay with the tobacco. I don't know what it is. Exactly. All right. Right? What else? All right, you're getting the idea. Now, when you think about the spending that you do, is it the case that, so, and because the comparable moral standard is very high, the question now is going to be, do we have to live up to the comparable moral standard as we're, as setting the criterion for whether we give or not? That is, if it's one of these things, you can buy it. If it's not, you ought to be spending the money on people who need it. That's the question. Is our bar supposed to be, is it, do we accept from the second premise that if it's not of comparable moral importance, you shouldn't be spending your money on it, you should be giving it to charity? Now, in order to ask, in order for him to make this claim, he uses a thought experiment. What do you think of this thought experiment? Saving a child when what is it, in a wading pool, when what is at risk is getting your shoes muddy. How do you think that racks up to what it is that you are now being asked to give up? Does that work for you? Why not? Would any of you not step in to a pool and grab a kid out no matter what shoes you had on, what pants you had on? Would anybody not get the kid? I wouldn't get the kid. Raise your hand. Right, of course, everybody's gonna get the kid. So he's got a very good thought experiment, but the question is, does the thought experiment deliver the premise? Why not?
There's a lot more sacrifice than a pair of shoes.
That's the thing. It is very nice sleight of hand to say that whenever you're not, to anchor the premise, you should give everything you've got unless it's of sacrificing this level of importance, because look, my example shows you would absolutely sacrifice this to save the life of the child. That's right, but what about all this? Is not anywhere near sacrificing shoes. It's not, down here, everybody would sacrifice it, of course. One pair of shoes for a person's life. Now let's run it like this. Let's imagine that one time you could, let's just say it like this. You could literally save someone's life if you sacrifice the car that you are driving. And I don't mean theoretically. I've never been able to concoct a really good scenario, but let's just imagine that your car will be absolutely destroyed if you drive it someplace where you would have to pick somebody up and rescue them. But you will not be in danger. I don't know how a scenario would be, but I want you to just picture, if it's true that a stranger's life actually depended on your car getting ruined and you not being able to get the full value of it back from your insurance, because, you know, after a while, like the 1994 Camry is worth about $50 if it gets totaled. But it runs perfectly fine and I have it today in the parking lot. Would I allow my 1994 Camry or whatever car, no, I also have a 2000 Sienna, would I allow either one of those cars to get fully destroyed if I could save this person in a very immediate way? How many people would sacrifice a car seriously for this person's life? Not theoretically. How many people would do it? Right, of course. The problem, though, is, and it would be hard, but you do it. I mean, you just go right over there. I mean, one time, of course.
A stranger? Like a crazy homeless person or something?
No, you wouldn't, but... I'm setting it up that this is a very innocent person, but it's something like...
Well, not like a kid, though, or a baby or something.
No, probably somebody who has has not been absolved of original sin or something. I mean, you know, a person who lives a normal life, but they're slipping down a cliff, I don't know what it is, and you would grab them, but your car would get ruined or something. I don't know how to give you a thing.
Some random guy's about to get hit by a car, and the only way to stop it is for you to ram that car.
Oh, good. There you go. See?
And it destroys your
not
car.
Not mechanical enough. That's right. Exactly.
You stop him from hitting you.
That's exactly right. Okay, good. And you don't know the guy. Maybe he is Jack the Ripper. Probably not, though, because there are very few of them. All right, the point is that in that kind of a thought experiment, most of us would say, how many times has that happened to you in life? You know, you'd say to yourself, oh my God, I am responsible for somebody being alive now. Okay, but the problem with famine and lack of shelter and medical care is it's all the time. It's all the time. It's a constant hemorrhage. And you could give up the car you have now, and then you get another car next week, and you'd have to give up that one, and that one, and that one, and it never ends. It's not this kind of moment where the wet shoes are all that's at stake, or even ratcheted up to the car being at stake, because it's an ever-present kind of giving. It's not a one-time, wow, I saved a life. Okay, so when we think about the save the child, when risking just one thing, we would all save a child, even if what we were risking was something important materially to us, if it was literally to save a child one time. You know, that some child's life actually being in our hand. But the question is, in terms of our general financial strategy, do we think that his evidence that you would absolutely do that on a one-time basis, on those extraordinary circumstances where you'd be called upon to save a life one time, does that show that if it's in your power at all to prevent anything bad, you should be sacrificing to the level of comparable moral importance? And most of us think no. But why? So what are the rejoinders for how you are allowed, from a deontological perspective, to spend money on the non-comparably moral important? The comparably moral important was your education, you know, protecting your family, whatever. It was not that much. You still have lots of money you spend that is not that stuff. How could the deontologist argue you're not obligated to give that money away? So I'm going to now present those arguments to you. So what I've argued so far is his thought experiment isn't strong enough to anchor number two. In my view, it anchors a different premise. If it's in my power to save someone's life right now with sacrificing something of material value to me, but I could literally save them and nothing else would I do it? Yes, I would. But this is a much, and that's what his premise, his thought experiment really does secure, a formulation of the premise like that. But his premise is so much more general than that, that it does lead to the conclusion that if you're not saving someone's life, and you're spending your money on something that doesn't rise to the level of saving someone's life, you shouldn't be spending the money.
But is his error then, we call it an error, is his error in his premise due to the thought experiment?
It's an overstatement of what the thought experiment can do. The thought experiment can show that if it's in my power, not to prevent something bad, to save someone's life from sacrificing something that isn't materially, is just material, then I should save that person's life.
What if his thought experiment, I mean, this is a what if, but what if his thought experiment had been, every time you give $100, you can save 1,000 kids in Africa from getting malaria?
Yes, that's great. And that's exactly where he is going. And so what I want to do is now give the deontological rejoinders for why you very well may have an obligation to give some money some of the time. That's not the same thing as saying that you must give all of the money that brings you to the same level as the person you're giving to. And that's what he's arguing with comparable moral importance. Okay, so the first argument I'm going to make is the duty to self argument. The imperfect duty to self argument. That's what I'm going to argue is the first one. And the deontologist argues it like this. Many of the purchases we make are in the service of serving one's own interest and needs. While it is certainly the case, for example, that some of the spending we do could be considered frivolous and isn't actually serving some important goal or value you have, some of the money you spend is actually in the service of important goals that you have. So can you, if you're a deontologist, you believe that there is an imperfect duty, meaning wide latitude, not telling you exactly what you have to do, but giving you wide choice, nevertheless, compelling you to develop your own talents and abilities, that you are an infinitely worthy creature and must serve the infinite worth that you are by not letting all of your talents and skills simply sit by the wayside and you just try to pick four-leaf clovers or flip the channels all day. Now obviously flip the channels all day is a big purchase, the flat screen TV, and it's not going to qualify under the imperfect duty self. But can you give me some examples where you might spend money on not, and let's not go with just education as in your college or graduate school or something like that. Can you tell me where you might be spending money on yourself or on your children, because you have to be the surrogate to help them develop their talents, where might you be spending money that would qualify as the imperfect duty to self?
Piano.
The arts.
Piano lessons, what?
The arts.
The arts, exactly.
Facial.
That's right. What is it?
Facials.
Yeah, it's not about serving yourself. It's about developing your talents. About developing.
If beauty was your talent, then you could spend money on facials. And
it's, I suppose, if that was your career. You know, more seriously, let's think about what you would do to develop your talents.
Sports activities.
Okay, like your gym membership, for
right.
example, that keeps your body healthy. Or maybe
hockey
you
stick.
Actually, play, what is it?
Hockey stick.
Yes, maybe, for example, you have a child who likes hockey, or maybe even you play on a rec league or something like that. That's just one of your passions. That's part of what you do kinesthetically. That's one of the things that you do as a physical person, not just in the service of being healthy, but because you have a certain skill set. It's a certain talent. Okay?
But I could argue vacation, and that I work so hard. If I didn't take
stress,
then I would
yes,
never.
Yes, absolutely,
be able
and I'm not saying you couldn't,
so.
But it would have to be like that.
Right.
So, for example, that would be one of the ways in which you preserve yourself. You know, you could argue maybe that beauty is something that has to be preserved. It certainly isn't the same thing as being mentally exhausted and unable to function, but whatever. Right? Okay, so, and in your children, this is very obvious, because in your hands are all of the potential talents that they have. So every art lesson that you give them, which is helping them be the person they're going to be, or every canvas you now buy that develops your talent, is something that qualifies for the deontologist as the imperfect duty to self that actually qualifies as a moral obligation. Now, it doesn't mean you have to develop all your talents. It doesn't mean there's no room, in fact, for other people, because there is also the imperfect duty to others. And that is the obligation to help others. And so there really is a need, an obligation to help other people in the deontological system, but it is imperfect. And that means that you have wide latitude, so you can judge how much you give and when you give and to whom you give. It is an imperfect duty. It does not require anything near marginal utility, taking yourself to marginal utility to fulfill. Because there no God, no Kant, no supermoral, you know, judge tells you how you are doing in terms of fulfilling your duty to help others. You have wide latitude, your own conscience, about how much you're going to give. And so the idea that you're obliged to give to the point where you're the same as anyone else has no place in the deontological system, because it is not perfect in the sense of no latitude. It is imperfect. Wide latitude to decide how it is that you are going to discharge that obligation in terms of the magnitude of what you give. So there, it's impossible to recognize for a deontologist can't recognize a compelling argument that says, I must give to the point of marginal utility. I must prevent everything bad from happening unless I'm preventing something bad from happening in my own life. No, that's not my obligation. My obligation is to help others, to look for ways that I can, and to decide how I'm going to do it. And then that gives us the corollary argument, which is there are many types of human pain for which the help others obligation addresses. In other words, famine, not having shelter, and not having medical care must absolutely be on the list of what causes humans pain. But deontologists don't hierarchize like Maslow might, right, in this hierarchy of needs, that there are certain kinds of needs more pressing than others. So can you talk to me, and where is this going? Because because it's an imperfect duty, you have wide latitude, you might decide there's a different type of human suffering that you want to focus on in your charitable obligations, whether that's financial or some other way. And it might not be to Oxfam. It might not be Oxfam. It might not be on a crusade to make sure everyone gets health insurance. It might not be working for Habitat for Humanity. It may be something else. And it might be to you, because deontologists aren't trying to prioritize and hierarchize, it's fully justifiable on the deontological system that you help others, and what you're helping them avoid isn't famine, poverty, famine, lack of medical care, and lack of shelter. So give me some ways in which you might discharge your obligations to help other people that do not involve food, shelter, and medical care.
Like if I had a friend who had a boyfriend break up with her, so we're out to dinner.
That's true. It's very local, right, to your own set. So it may not qualify as charity. It's certainly kind of help of others, but you might be the rock, you know, of support for friends in your friendship circle. Deontologists might not give you that much credit for that one in the imperfect duty to others, because the fact that you already agreed to be that person's friend comes with certain obligations, and this is sort of like double dipping your chip, right? You're obligated because you're the friend, and then you say, and I can count that as my help others too. You know, maybe, but you kind of already committed. It's sort of like saying, here's the example. I don't have to give money to famine relief because I feed my own children. It's got that character to it. Let's see if we can think a little bit broader.
It's like rather than giving to a local homeless shelter, you give back to your university or your...
Okay, you, in terms of money donations, you might support your university. What else might you support? Let's just do financial for a while. What else?
Environmental causes.
Yeah, you might support environmental causes. You might support the American Cancer Society, the Breast Cancer Walk, the Susan, you know, Komen Foundation, whatever, any disease. What else?
Politician.
What is it?
Politician.
Yes, you might, a political cause, because you might see that that money would actually translate into certain types of good in the world when that individual got in. Mm-hmm. What else?
The arts, underserved. The
arts, okay. The underserved, right, in some way. Right?
Radio.
What?
Public radio.
Right. That's right, absolutely. There, you know, whatever, NPR is counting on that from the upper middle class, basically, right? Okay. Now let's think outside of the financial. How might you qualify as discharging your imperfect duty to others without involving money? Because there is no, because this is wide latitude, the deontologist, I mean, it's most deontologists can't have a clear conscience if they're very, very, very wealthy and they don't give a dime away, right? It's sort of like, but there are circumstances in your life where, for example, money is, it's not the right moment in the life course for it. So you might be saying, right now, I'm discharging my obligation to help others by doing what?
And Avery's ill and you decide to take
all right, Meals on Wheels, for example, or you might be providing meals for a particular person, okay? You might volunteer, you might coach, for example, okay? You might donate your clothes. You might donate your furniture. Right, exactly. Right. What else? What other causes might you work for?
Free medical clinic, volunteer medical clinic.
Okay, you might volunteer your medical expertise, for example, by working at a free clinic. As a lawyer, you might do pro bono work, for example, on the side, as a public, you know, some kind of public service, many different ways. Okay, what else? What other causes might you get involved in that aren't about famine, shelter, and medical care?
Education, Teach for America.
Right, you might do Teach for America, you might do literacy, you might do English as a second language volunteering.
Big Brother.
Big Brother, Big Sister. That's right, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts. Okay, what about working in a women's shelter? You know, working to end domestic violence, working in a rape crisis center, working on a suicide hotline. For the deontologist, there are so many types of human pain that are you actually gonna tell me that working a suicide hotline is very inferior to working for a famine cause? How could you? A deontologist wouldn't understand what you would mean. For the person who's the infinitely worthy being that is about to take her life off the planet, how could it be trivial compared to someone starving? There's no way to hierarchize that pain. For the person who's that desperate, there couldn't be any more pain than the pain that's causing you to perhaps take your own life. You know, the deontologist isn't going to engage in the hierarchizing of pain. And so if you work for, you know, to help the blind or whatever, some kind of interpreter skills or who knows what, the deontologist is not going to say that you are in the wrong side of the hierarchy of what's important.
What if it's not free? What if you're getting compensated for it, but it's still clearly a charitable act, like if you did Doctors Without Borders or Peace Corps, where you're clearly...
Because you're making so much less than what you could, by the fact that you're sustaining yourself doesn't count against it. I mean, even priests and rabbis get paid, right?
Right?
I mean, and by which I mean, I don't know how well certain ministers and rabbis do, but I know, for example, Jesuits have to live right down there at the poverty line, and we're going to say, well, we gave you $500 this month, so you don't get to count your life's work as service. No, of course not. We all live in a capitalist system, so you have to have some money coming in. You know, besides the nunhood, you know, where you, I don't know if you get any money at all, but, you know, most people, it's, are you working significantly under market value in your career? Well, then that gap has to be understood as what you're donating. Okay, let's talk about, this deny the premise argument is simply to say that if you're a deontologist, it's just not compelling that you have an obligation to create the greatest happiness for the greatest number. And without that, there's no motivation to be doing the most, because it's not maximizing. But I want to talk about the life being worth living argument as something. So four, I just said, you know, it's the fundamental first premise that may not be mentioned here, but it's what's underlying the motivation to do the most and the maximum. But the life worth living argument is worth looking at, I think, for a minute. And it goes like this. And this is probably more where the arts fit in than in the help others, though it is charitable giving. And that is that on this understanding of how we ought to conduct our financial life, bare minimum existence of everyone is the supreme goal. It's the supreme value in human life. Get everybody eating, get everybody in shelter, get everybody medical care. But the life worth living argument retorts back, if that's what human life was, we could all just eat, and we could have our biscuits, and we could sustain ourselves, and we could have shelter, that wouldn't be life that we call meaningful. And those folks who have the biscuits also wouldn't call that life meaningful. In fact, I think this is Ethiopia that he's talking about at the time? But let's take Ethiopia as an example, because we know they've had some very famous famines. While it is certainly the case that anyone in Ethiopia would have been glad for a UNICEF biscuit to get through that crisis, they have a century-old cuisine that is so much more superior than the biscuits. And they want to get back to being able to have a cuisine. And as you know, if you've ever gone to an Ethiopian restaurant, it's very elaborate. It's filled with spices and textures, and it's not enough to have a biscuit. And so they don't either want to live their life having a biscuit. Or if you think about other places that you might consider to be at risk for these concerns. There is dancing and music and arts in those other places. And so there's something beyond mere subsistence, the gray of just having enough to eat, that human beings have deemed worthwhile. And that is about the food and the wine and the ability to commune with others and dancing and whatever, and clothing even, right? I mean, you think about one of the country's quite poor nations, Pakistan. They have a tradition of extraordinary clothing, to speak to your point, of many different textures and fabrics. So the idea that you, yes, privileged to not have to be just a biscuit eater, want to spend your life spending money on festivals and food and, you know, cultural observations and sporting events and the other things that make life rich and textured, doesn't separate you from anyone else on the globe. It just means right now you can and they can't, and that is tragic. But when you go to any of the nations that you might be candidates here, you are talking about places like Afghanistan is another one that have, you know, if not millennia, century-long traditions of believing that life was more than just subsistence with their art and their objects and their pottery and their architecture. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that you're going to spend some of your resources living a life that is meaningful in that sense is really an affirmation of what it is that you want everyone to do. But the deontologist isn't very susceptible to the argument that until everybody can, no one can, because that's just the end of culture and arts and all of the rest of it. So while that tragedy that not everyone can participate fully in the culture of their own nation or you know, of people, religion or tribe or whatever, is not an argument that the rest of those who can shouldn't, because as soon as they can, they will, right? As soon as the famine ended in Ethiopia, they stopped with the damn biscuits and went back to the spongy bread and all the rest of it. So this is the argument that on this read, you've actually taken away what makes life worth living. So yes, everybody can live, maybe, if we all got ourselves to this subsistence living, but it wouldn't be a life that would be satisfying, and it's not a life that you would even advocate for your, for anyone else, and certainly not for yourself. Okay, I don't know whether any of those arguments feel compelling to you, but I just want to wrap up a little bit here. I've already talked about the hypocrisy argument. I can get rid of the consequentialist argument very quickly because it's a very powerful argument, but let's talk about it to make sure we get it on the table. A consequentialist who believes that we need to maximize the greatest good for the greatest number could still passionately object to giving away money to the point of marginal utility on an economic ground, which would be what?
If you give away less now, you'll have the propensity, or in the long run, you'll give away more. So maybe, you know, if you only give away a small amount now, you'll, you know, I'm not articulating this, but if you give away everything you can right now, you're not going to be able to give over time.
Okay, all right. Especially if you sacrifice certain abilities to generate more wealth. In other words, okay, and there's corollaries to this, and that's definitely one piece of it. If you know ahead of time, deciding what you're going to do for your career, that every dime you make beyond the biscuit and the medical care and the shelter is going to have to be given to charity, then what kind of life choices do you make about what it is that you want to do? Right. So if your work is inherently fulfilling, then you're not going to care that you make the same as someone who's working not as hard in a job that didn't require all the sacrifice if it's inherently so fulfilling. But if it's hard work, I'm not making this argument. I'm making this on behalf of the consequentialists who are economists. If you give away the incentive to work harder and make more money or have jobs that pay more, then we will not have people who do those jobs that pay more and generate more money, and over time we won't have the surplus income that actually enables you to buy the biscuits. And so you will create a workforce that isn't working hard, and this is kind of the nightmare that East Germany found itself in when West Germany and East Germany became one country, because West Germans had been incentivized by the ability to profit from their labor, and East Germans hadn't. And even now, that generation that wasn't born after unification still struggles with the fact that the West Germans are always ahead, even when the education is similar, and that's because of things like ambition. Because the economists have pointed out socialism failed and capitalism succeeded, though it's got some real bumpy parts to it, no doubt about it. But it doesn't, I mean, I don't know whether you're a socialist or not. I'm talking about the consequentialists who will make this argument. But their basic argument is that less wealth will be generated, and when less wealth is generated, there are fewer biscuits. Okay. So there is a consequentialist argument against Singer, and it tends to go in that direction. Let's talk about charity versus duty. We can talk about that very quickly, too. His argument is, if you are obligated to create the greatest happiness for the greatest number, then the right thing to do is that which, we talked about this last week, that which delivers the greatest good for the greatest number. And that is what's right. So don't tell me that when you give away everything that's not of comparable moral importance, you're doing charity. You're just doing what you have to do. You're doing what's right, because that is what's right. So don't go saying to yourself, well, charity's optional. Well, he's saying charity's not optional. I've already showed you how a deontologist thinks it is. It's optional in the way that you discharge it. You can't say, well, I've got an option to ever be charitable. No, you have an option of when to be charitable, but you have to be charitable at some point. But for a consequentialist, he's arguing, it's just what is right. Now, there is a consequentialist argument we saw that says that even if maximizing the greatest good for the greatest number is what's right, giving all your money away, having everybody give all their money away, is actually not that which will generate the greatest happiness for the greatest number. But if it were the case that that's the only way we could get the greatest happiness for the greatest number, then it would be the right thing to do. It wouldn't be charity. Okay. And now I want to talk about the last two points. The deontologist is going to say this. In a crisis like the tsunami, the whole world, anyone who's not suffering at the level of the tsunami or is just struggling to survive, like at the poverty line, everyone else needs to band together and give some amount of money, something, to the tsunami crisis. It was of such a proportion. You think about earthquakes that are of that proportion to the tsunami crisis in Indonesia. A deontologist will say, I will grant you that I have let's say, 1/4 of a billion or, you know, 1/1,000,000,000th of an obligation to this problem. Because let's say there's 1 billion people on the planet who could do something, could give something. Then my obligation as one member of the human community is to give 1/1 the total number of people on the planet who are in the position to be able to help. That is my obligation. I will grant that that's my obligation. But I will not grant that because 3/4 of the world ignore the problem of those who could give. I'm only talking about those who could give. That I've got 20 times that obligation because other people are morally lazy. A deontologist will argue, I have exactly the same share as everybody else who can. That is, I must give something. I don't know how much. We could talk about that. That's what the New York Times article is about. But he says, you're not less obligated just because others could help and don't. That is, if because I'm one of the people willing to do this, I'm obligated to give 80% of my salary, he says. I say in response to him, I'm obligated to give 80% of my salary, but somebody else is giving a fraction of 1% who makes the same amount I do. And he says to me, you're not less obligated just because that person's not giving. And I say back, I am less obligated. I am not obligated to give 80% when someone who's situated the same as me is giving nothing. I'm obligated to give the exact same amount, at least as everyone who makes what I make, or at least I'm obligated to give at some level, just like everyone else who's situated in a way that they can give. So here, Singer and the deontologists are simply, you know, at loggerheads. The deontologist will not accept that I need to pick up the slack because you all aren't giving. I'll be sad that my contribution won't address the problem as effectively as if we were all doing our share. That does not, for a deontologist, burden me with more of the share because you're not doing yours. And you can see now from all of this discussion why that would be true. Because a deontologist doesn't accept that my obligation is to create the greatest happiness for the greatest number. My obligation is the imperfect duty to help others. So I'll take my share of the responsibility. Just like in West Germany, they divided up the cost with all the people in Germany of what it was going to take to reunify. They didn't say, okay, who's volunteering? You guys give up 80% of your salary and the slackers do nothing. It was a deontological straight across the board, everybody's got to give. Now maybe there was some sliding scale, fine. But if everybody's giving, a deontologist will be involved. But I'm not going to give more just because others aren't. And then he argues, you might say, and I know we got to wrap it up, but he says, you might get there 20 years after the problem. And the problem then has gone from being this large, the whole pie, to having some of it solved. And so now, when you get there, there's actually less of the problem to solve. And so your obligation is to actually give less, because now there isn't as much need. So if at the beginning, let's even put it like this. There was so much of the problem to solve, you had to give 80% of your income to solve it. But now you get there 10 years later, and you only have to give 20% of your income to solve the problem.